Well, good day to you, one and all, wherever you may be. Welcome to Observations. We're here with Scott Kirk, and I'm Craig. You know, I received an email this morning. We were talking about before the show began, and it pertains to a fellow named Ron Wyatt. Name ring a bell, Kirk?
He's covered all kind of things, including the Ark of the Covenant. And
yeah. He's the fellow that began his archaeological investigations looking for Noah's Ark made a model of the mountains of Ararat, a 3D model, and then he made a 3D model of to scale of the Ark, so both of those can be made to scale, and then he filled that area with water. And then he watched where the ark would come to rest if, in fact, it was near the mountains of Ararat when the water subsided. Mm-hmm. And based upon the hydrodynamics of water and how it literally pushes things away from elevated places as opposed to drawing them to the elevated place, he was the first to say, wait a minute, there is no chance whatsoever that the ark is on the top of Mount Ararat or even on the sides of the mountain. It can be among the mountains. It can be, in the vicinity. It could even be on a portion of the range of what is Ararat. But it isn't on Ararat. The hydrodynamic flow of water would preclude that. So the guy was thoughtful, and he began the process that way. And then what he did is, after conducting his experiments, and he saw that the ark came to rest in the same place every time, around Ararat. So he, and it was southwest of the actual mountain, very close to, not too far from Lake Van, kind of halfway between Lake Van and Turkey. So this is in eastern Turkey. This would be the Kurdish area where, there's a lot of bad stuff that's going on and has for a long time. And so he set off to see if he could find it based upon what he had done, and had a devil of a time getting to proximity of Mount of the location in the foothills of Ararat that he was looking for, because it's so primitive in eastern Turkey. But eventually he got there, and there was the ark. And it was available to be seen in this really desolate region because of the fact that Ararat itself is a volcanic range. And some of the, with erosion over time and earthquakes and the like, part of the ark became visible as a result of the erosion and earth movement. And part of the ark that became visible had actually been preserved, very much like Herculaneum and Pompeii are preserved to this day. When he went there, and he saw this portion of the ark, he found out that the length was the dimensions laid out in cubits for the ark.
Oh.
And then he said, but the width didn't match. And then it dawned on him, of course the width doesn't match. It's wider than the ark is supposed to be. Because what happens if you were to set a boat or a ship out of wood with wood beams? And then you're going to have it sit there for a long time, and it's going to be then filled with very heavy rock and volcanic debris. But rock, what's going to happen?
Well, in the snow too, it's going to bend it.
It's going to splay, which means that the beams that are holding it together across the midsection are going to fail, and the sides of the boat are going to fall away. You know, it happens in wrecks even made out of steel over time. You know, the hydrodynamic force of water sort of pushes them in when the ship is in the water, but when it's out of the water, the ship is going to want to splay, which means it's going to want to open up at the top. And so that's what he found had happened. And it was interesting. He took samples of the wood. I've seen them in his museum. And the resin content is consistent with the resinous wood. I use the term glue lambs. There's some that would criticize that as a specific term, because a glue lamb is actually made not only with wood and layers of wood and glue, but also pressure. And heat, and he would have had heat, but nothing for pressure.
Nice pressure.
But still, it's pretty obvious that that if you read God's instructions, that the resinous material that he was asked to make the ark out of was yesteryear's glue lamps. But beyond even that, he also took samples of the rivets of the. And there, you know, there's bolts that were used to secure the planks and the beams together. And the metallurgy of those is very similar to what we would have today in a stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
And it had all of the same components that we would have in steel. In other words, this was 3000 BCE. And so 5,000 years ago, so 3,000 BCE, most of, you know, humankind was still in the Stone Age, and yet they're very, very sophisticated metallurgy that was used to do this. And if God didn't provide the instructions on how to create that metal, there is, you know, you're not going to hold a ship of that size together using brass or bronze.
Mm-hmm. Now, would the Moloch have helped?
I don't think so. It could have. Oh, it could have. But, you know, it could have. I mean, absolutely could have. They would have had the strength to provide all the help in the world, and it's not explained. And, you know, all we're told is God gave, these are the instructions God gave. The instructions he gave are the perfect dimensions for a ship of that size. You know, if you look at the great battleships like the Bismarck, same dimensions. You look at the great super tankers, exactly the same dimension. I don't mean, like, approximate. I mean, if you take the freeboard, the length overall, and the beam of the arc, and you compare it to the same dimensions of our largest battleships, aircraft carriers, super tankers, which would be, you know, on the same kind of scale, exact. I mean, it's exact. I mean, and we're talking about measurements in three dimensions that are precisely designed based upon the most sophisticated naval ships of our day.
Ever, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, you look at that and say, well, so he gave very good instructions. He talked about glue lamps. He talked about the number of decks that he wanted, the number of doorways, because that was symbolic of the three destinations of human souls. And all we know is that and after giving those specific instructions, that Noah did exactly as Yahweh had instructed. He didn't say, oh, God, that part's way too rough. You know what I think I need? I need a New Testament that my family is going to be saved if we just believe.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, there's a real eye-opener for Christians. No, what did he say? He listened.
Uh-huh.
And then he engaged
the path he was given.
Following the instructions that Yahweh had provided. So it's a marvelous story in that regard. And, of course, the story of the rainbow, where the seven fundamental colors of light, Roy G. Biv, you know, are manifest before us. And how that is symbolic of the fullness of light, and how we will, as covenants, the covenant's children, are going to become light-based, energy-based, spiritual creatures as a result of the covenant. It's the perfect sign for the covenant. In fact, the Ark of the Covenant, which we'll get to in a moment, the entire back wall of the room was a prismatic rainbow of colors, according to Ron Wyatt. The same rainbow is the backdrop for the Ark of the Covenant, because the Ark of the Covenant and Noah's Ark are essentially the same thing. They are the means to get from our world, and troubled as it is, as stormy as it is, as rough as it is, as deadly as it is, to Yahweh's perfect realm in heaven of light. So, Ron Wyatt survived all manner of risk and all manner of difficulty after a systematic and thoughtful appraisal of where the Ark was and found it. Now, I have been to his museum. I was there because I was taking one of my sons to Vanderbilt for a tour. And it's in the shadow of Vanderbilt, so I went there. And I have seen the wood. I have examined the metal. And I have seen the model that he created showing where the Ark must be. And when I went back and I read the whole account, and the whole account is marvelous, including the stone that he found and pictured that shows the eight souls leaving the Ark that's dated to that time. The thing that was most amazing to me is you just look at that whole scene is that Ron did a marvelous job of documenting it. And then I went home and I Google Earth. And what I did is I used the directions that Ron had provided as to where this thing is. And I've subsequently came to realize, based on Ron's writings, that although he's given no credit for finding the Ark, the Turkish government created a national, in fact, a World Heritage Site around the Ark. Right. Built an interpretive center that overlooks the Ark. And so I used Google Earth. And it took me 5 or 6 hours of searching. Found it. And it is absolutely a boat. There's the interpretive center overlooking it. Clearly, the dimensions of a boat right there. So if you can see it with your own eyes. And it's right where it needed to be. And someone might say, and this was the purpose of this email this morning, was the person says, I have a hard time believing that Yah would choose, pick, if you will, a man who clearly had no clue as to the truth of the matter, particularly of the Moed Mikre, the invitations to meet with God and be called out of this world, to be welcomed into his presence, to reveal these things. You know, why would Yah allow a man who uses Jesus and Christ to as a implement in this regard? And I'm going to tell you, and Kirk, you wrote me back based on my reply, and I want you to share your example. But what I told him, and we're going to go through the other things that Ron found, because I think they're truly impactful. Mm-hmm. Is it possible for God to remain in character, for him to be consistent, and him to deliberately preclude an individual from knowing him?
Preclude someone from knowing?
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, no. Is it in his nature to make it especially difficult for somebody to know him?
Not really.
No, so if, I mean, he does not make it easy for any of us to know him. It's by design. But if you were to... Let's say, Kirk, that you heard, as your wife actually heard, Terry heard me on a radio program and said, you know, there's some things this guy said that are either, they've got to be the craziest, most ridiculous statements in the world, but for some reason they resonate with me. I think he's onto something. Mm-hmm. Let's find out if he's telling the truth or not. And that was essentially it. And then you went about to verify whether or not what I was saying, because it was so inconsistent with politics and religion.
Right.
And what the world thinks of God, that you went and checked it. Would it have been in Yahweh's nature to make that search, that every time you tried to look up a passage and tried to define the words, that your internet would have crashed when you Googled something to look it up, or that the books that you bought would have been sold out from every store, so that even if you were to buy them, he would somehow see to it that they were destroyed?
No, it's totally inconsistent. He wouldn't do that.
No, he wouldn't do that. So if Ron Wyatt was devoted to finding the Ark, which exists because Noah followed Yahweh's instructions and built it, and Yahweh's instructions were trustworthy. So it was there to be found. If he sought out to find it, would God make it difficult, precluded for finding it, even if he did not know him?
No, not at all.
No, wouldn't be in his nature.
It's a narrow path. It's not a blocked path.
Right. Now, as it relates to me, I was found it interesting that he found the Ark of the Covenant. Not the Ark of the Covenant. We'll be on that in a moment, but Noah's Ark. Right. I didn't need to know that. It wasn't, for example, I wouldn't go out of my way. I wouldn't risk anything to go to Eastern Turkey to look at it. I wouldn't do the spend the money or the time to do the metallurgy examples. I wouldn't test the timbers to ascertain their age. I wouldn't do any of it because its existence is essentially irrelevant to me. Other than I'm glad to know where it is, because once I came to know where it is, I was able to use the rest of the directions that we are provided in Bereshith to systematically locate Eden and then look at mankind's movement, mankind with a nesama related to Adam and Chawa, movement from Eden through the Fertile Crescent down ultimately to Ur. And then I was able to retrace that to identify the area that was subject to the flood. So were there some aspects of it that were helpful? Yes.
Sure.
But going to see it myself, proving it, that it is, in fact, the Ark, be irrelevant to me.
Mm-hmm.
At least that Ark. Be irrelevant to me.
Right.
But it was relevant to him because our mindset's different.
Mm-hmm.
So you and I, we benefited from what we learned based upon what... I'm glad he did it. Right. I'm glad he did it. But I look at the Ark of the of Noah as one of the most beautiful presentations of the covenant of Yahweh, enabling a man who was willing to listen to him and trust him to save his family and to safeguard life while he eliminated and distanced himself forever from those who were violent and corrupt. And that by acting upon what Yahweh had instructed, Noah and his family were spared. And that mankind with the Nesama, who was violent and cruel and deceiving and conniving, was destroyed.
Yeah.
It's a marvelous presentation of the covenant. That's how I look at it.
Right. It's always what you learn from the story is far more important than what you...
Than the object.
Absolutely.
Right, yeah. So the object doesn't mean anything to me. Although I'm fascinated by how Yahweh goes to such great lengths to demonstrate that he can be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next thing that Ron Wyatt found was the Nuweiba Beach crossing. Now, it seemed obvious. It just really seems obvious that they would have to be at Nuweiba Beach.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is there's only one place where hundreds of thousands of people could have assembled on the shore of the Red Sea. This is actually the Gulf of Aqaba. A branch of the Red Sea. There's only one place that is big enough, flat enough, wide enough for 600,000 to a million people or more to have gathered. And there's only one place where the canyons through the mountains are consistent with the description that Yahweh provides in the Exodus account.
Well, isn't there a marker that Solomon put there?
Yes, there was.
I mean, so...
Yes, there was. It's gone now, but there was at the time, and Ron took a picture of it. But Nuweiba Beach, that's the place. And if you... Then you look at the area under the Gulf of Aqaba. There's only one place that should the water have been pushed back that people could have walked across. Because most of it is so steep and so deep that if you push back the water... You'd have to be Tenzing Norgay and company to make it down and up.
Right.
You need climbing gear. And so that's the one place where it's a very, very subtle and soft descent and back up on the other side. It's what you would call a land bridge. And so he went
right.
That's the only place that carriages could have followed them, is over that land bridge that that extends across the Gulf of Aqaba, right there from Nuweiba Beach. And so he went down and he did some diving to see if he could find the chariot wheels. Now that's trusting Yahweh. That's saying, you know, I think that the story is right from a history point of view. By the way, it wasn't Ramses, and so the discovery program that shows one of Ramses' kids with a hole in his head because somebody knocked his brains out wasn't Ramses.
No.
The city was Ramesses, which is interesting. Another affirmation that the Torah can be trusted because the Torah was written in a phonetic language, and the and it is begins with the R A H M Y S. You know, it's phonetically Ramses, the city, not the man, not the pharaoh. The pharaoh is not named in the account. The city was named, but Ra is the name of the Egyptian sun god, Amen-Ra. Amen was one of their sun gods, Ra was the other sun god, and they ultimately joined them together as one sun god. It became Amen-Ra. So Ramses is the son of Ra. And so the city was named after the sun god Ra. And anyway, they have found David Roll is the author of the book. It's About Time. It's a marvelous read. I would encourage anyone to get it. It's out of print, but you can buy it through secondhand bookstores. It's About Time by David Roll. I write about much of what he said and yada yada. And he has found all of the proof of every detail of that story. Well, Ron White, the same situation. He said, you know, there's going to be evidence of the chariots that went across this land bridge. And yes, there are. And he's not the only one that's found them, and he photographed them. And they're there to be seen. Now, the story of the Exodus doesn't do you any good unless you know the Torah. Unless you understand the Torah. You know, it's one thing for Ron Wyatt to think that the Torah is true and to know what the Torah says and to find Nuweiba Beach, the canyon that was set afire to keep the Egyptian army back, the land bridge that they crossed, the monument that was erected by Solomon that has Yahweh's name on it. And on the other side, he found Horeb. And by the way, it's surrounded right now by chain link fence by the Saudi Arabian government because it's obviously Horeb. And you can find the platform that the you can look at the platform that the Israelites built for the golden calf. You know, the Apis cult in Egypt. Was extraordinary. It was the royal court. They were building royal cities. The royal cult in Egypt was the bull cult. So this was a bull with a sun-disc ring between its horns. That's the golden calf. The golden bull. And you can see it to this day. You can even see the rock that Moshe struck as opposed to talking to that brought forth the living waters, and the waterway that emerged from it, still there. And the top of the mountain is as burnt as it can possibly be. It's black. And if you don't think so, use Google Earth. You can see all of this. Now, it's one thing to know that it's there. Did you need Ron Wyatt to tell you it was there, to know it was there?
No. Yahweh said it was there. He's pretty trustworthy.
Yeah, he's really trustworthy. What's important is what the story tells us. The Exodus is the living embodiment of the Moed Mikre. It begins with Pesach, the doorway to life. It progresses through a matzah, unyeasted bread, where you remove religious and political, militaristic and economic sin. And then as you become eternal and perfected, your position to be Bokurim, the firstborn children, the children of Yisrael, adopted into Yahweh's family. And then seven sevens later, you have Shavuah, where Yahweh enriches us and empowers us and enlightens us. What happened in Shavuah during the midst of the Exodus?
Well, that's when they gave him the Torah.
That is correct. The ultimate source of enrichment,
sure,
and enlightenment.
If
you understand that Yahweh took them away from the slavery that was induced by religion and politics, because he hates these things, and then led them to the promised land through the Moed Mikre, then you understand the reason for the Exodus story, that Yahweh is about liberation. Mm-hmm. Freedom from the institutions of man that are so enslaving and debilitating to living with him in the promised land.
Well, you
That's
know,
the story.
You know, if you started out with the tablet of stones, the introduction before he even says anything is he says, I took you out of slavery.
That's correct.
And then he gives you all the rest of the messages on the stone or don't go back and be right. enslaved. Here's how you avoid it.
Right. Was Moshe a liberator or was Yahweh the liberator?
You know, he took them away. He drew them out.
Right. Yeah, so when Paul wrote that the Torah enslaves, he was a dunderhead. It's too kind.
Yeah.
But all right.
It doesn't do you any good to know that story if you're going to just celebrate Seder.
Right, and if you think that knowing the location of Mount Horeb, which is not where Constantine was a scumbag, and his mommy no better. It's not where Constantine's mommy declared it. It's not where the monastery is in the Sinai Desert. Mount Horeb's in Arabia.
Right.
It's directly across from the Nuweiba Beach crossing. But knowing its location, while interesting, doesn't cause me to have one iota of greater confidence in the Torah's veracity.
It's wonderful to know all those places. It's wonderful to know where the Hebrews were, a town in Egypt where you can find the granaries and all that stuff. It makes historical accuracy better. Mm-hmm. However, that doesn't show you the path.
Correct. Correct. Now, he also found Sodom. And one of the things that was interesting about Sodom is he took pictures. You can actually see the walls of the largest buildings in Sodom is kind of heaps of ruins. But he brought back the brimstone. And just for giggles, when I was there, he had since died, but the curator of his museum took a little slice of one of the pieces of brimstone. And it's just kind of grayish kind of stuff. And he picked up, you know, hundreds and hundreds of them while he was there. And he chipped off a little bit, put it in a spoon, and lit it on fire. It is so hot, it melts right through the spoon.
Really?
It glows with a green hot. I mean, it is just unbelievably hot.
Wow.
Yeah, it would have incinerated anything. So he found Sodom. I'm glad he found Sodom. I think it's interesting. I also think that it's interesting that I've seen Sodom because I went to that part of Israel. That Sodom is directly below Jerusalem. And if you go directly down from the Mount of Olives, right down the slopes to the Dead Sea, where that's where Sodom is.
Rather symbolic, don't you think?
Yeah, it's rather symbolic. Yeah, right there on the Dead Sea. So I thought that was, and he found that was interesting. But it's his last find that he has absolutely no proof of. Try to take a picture. He'll show you the picture. It's just nothing but little smudges of light. He has no artifact from. As a matter of fact, his own family is trying to distance him from that find.